I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views. Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. Before we get to this edition of the show, I just want to promote Wall Street Window, a website maintained by Mike Swanson that provides valuable insights on both financial markets and geopolitics. It's been around since 2003, and its slogan is "Be in the Know," and I highly recommend it as daily reading. So go on over to wallstreetwindow.com and keep yourself informed. This edition of Parallax Views is brought to you by the $10 and above tier supporters of Parallax Views on Patreon. So, with that in mind, producers credit shoutouts to Gunner, Mark, Alexander, Catherine, Tilo, Emilia, Jeff, John, Bert, Brian, Elliot, Michael, Brace, Nick,
Meresham,
Galen, Arlen, Beau,
Christopher, Michael,
Gigadelic Media, Chance, Chase, Dan,
David H, Y Kellerman, Saadad 13,
Kathleen, David,
Ava,
Bob,
The West Bank Robbery Podcast,
Jamie,
Enoch,
Gary,
Max,
Ishtofer, James, Martin, Matthew Ho,
Brian,
Nobody, Thomas, and Dano. And now on to the show.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be speaking with Sean Tomlinson, author of the Responsible Statecraft piece entitled "What the French Evisceration of Algeria Has to Do with Gaza Today." We're going to specifically be discussing the Algerian War of Independence with a specific focus on French counterinsurgency during France's occupation of Algeria and what are the lessons that we can learn from that counterinsurgency strategy in regards to what is happening today in Gaza. This conversation was recorded at the end of March before the events of April 13th and the Iranian attack that occurred this past week. I hope you find the conversation insightful. And with that being said, let's get right to it with Sean Tomlinson. Welcome to Parallax Views, a guest that I'm very happy to be speaking with. Sean Tomlinson is a PhD candidate in Middle Eastern and North African Studies at the University of Arizona. He is a graduate of West Point and a U.S. Army veteran, and the author of a piece we're going to be talking about from our friends at Responsible Statecraft, entitled "What the French Evisceration of Algeria Has to Do with Gaza Today." How are you doing, Sean?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm doing good. It's dark times, though, with regards to international relations and foreign policy and whatnot. But let's get into this article. So, Sean, one of the areas you explored in this article is the Philippeville massacre in Algeria, and you compare that incident from 1955 to October 7th and the events of that day and the current war in Gaza that came out of the October 7th attack. What's the parallels that you draw?
Yeah, thank you. So I lead off the article with a description of what was then called the Philippeville Massacre. It was a shocking attack by a regional group of Algerian FLN, that's the National Liberation Front, led militants near what is today the Algerian city of Skikda. So the attack killed over 100 European and Algerian civilians, predominantly women, children, and the elderly, inside their homes and it included acts of sexual violence and mutilation. This attack coincided with a series of attacks in the area targeting French military and administrative facilities. Once French military units learned of this attack, they responded quickly and brutally, with often indiscriminate reprisals and summary executions. Varying estimates put the death toll in the thousands. One French soldier remarked that there were so many dead bodies of Algerians that they had to be buried with bulldozers. This event served as a turning point for the escalation of the Algerian War of Independence, which lasted from 1954 to 1962. So this was a year into that. It captured the attention of the French military and the public as a result of the terror tactics employed by the FLN. But to a large degree, this is exactly what the FLN intended when they planned many of these attacks and subsequent actions that targeted civilians through bombings and assassinations. They knew from previous French indiscriminate reprisals against civilians that the French military would brutalize civilians who were largely unaffiliated with the FLN, but who, after suffering French bombings, home destructions, detention, destruction of crops, torture, forced displacement, and other attacks, would eventually join or support the FLN-led independence struggle. So while there are major differences between Algeria and Israel-Palestine, I believe this episode serves as a cautionary warning for the Israeli military's response to Hamas's October 7 attacks. The French military's assessment that the FLN's attacks at Philippeville were a military problem that could be solved by a military solution missed the larger context of the political struggle for Algerian independence that had erupted through military resistance intermittently since the 1830s. Similarly, the Israeli government's pursuit of an overwhelmingly brutal military victory against Hamas, with devastating civilian casualties, now over 30,000, ignores the wider context of the Palestinian struggle for self-determination and political rights within which Hamas has seized leadership. So accordingly, like the French in Algeria, overwhelming and disproportionate military force will only protract this conflict because it will create new enemies and it will destroy options for alternative resolutions by emboldening hardliners and eliminating off-ramps and possible alternative resolutions.
For background, maybe you could talk a little bit about France and Algeria.
Sure. The history of the French and Algeria is fascinating, tragic, and very devastating, of course. But there's a lot of relevant points that have been drawn on by historians over the last 20 odd years. So it's sort of come back in vogue a few times as that I've seen, especially as the US Army has conducted operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. People have tried applying various lessons or what the lessons that they choose to learn of the French experience in Algeria. And so, I've encountered the background of the French experience in Algeria multiple times, and so it's interesting to now reconsider it in the present context. But to get to your point, my apologies. So the French experience in Algeria begins in the 1830s. I mean, there are connections going on before that, but for our purposes today, so the French invaded Algeria in 1830, which this is an interesting time. This is a time of Les Mis and Victor Hugo and all these other things going on in Europe and connections around the world. So the French invade Algeria, and they initially encounter fierce opposition and resistance. They, over the course of multiple decades, they use the term pacification of Algeria, of mostly the big cities on the coastline. There's a major resistance movement, multiple fights. And over the course of several decades, they take control of much of Algeria. It's a brutal, brutal series of campaigns. And historians have looked at these campaigns. And I mean, the tactics that they use to try and deprive rebel groups of their livelihoods using this technique called the razzia. They, you know, seize the economic base of rural society and confiscate livestock. I mean, they devastate the local economy to try and break the back of the opposition. And so over the course of multiple decades and a lot of fighting, eventually they expand their control in Algeria. They begin settling Algeria with colonists from really all over the Mediterranean, but they impose like French control over it and French administration. So this gradually expands, and I'm probably taking way too much time, but I want sort of the takeaway.
No. I think that's good. I think people need the background. I mean, and, you know, as they're doing this, they don't really address the issues that Algerians, you know, may have with all of this, you know, so that becomes an issue. And really, you know, issues related to like autonomy, peaceful demands for independence, these are sort of ignored by the French, and the French sort of fixate on, oh, well, the FLN uses terror tactics, and they don't really address the legit political grievances.
Well, that, like, what's interesting is there's that happened, like that mischaracterization happens, you know, in the 19th century as well, and so the you get this curious appreciation by some people who are on the ground from the French who say, like, you know, these punitive expeditions that we're doing, many of which were incredibly brutal, and they were reporting these actions. They're saying, you know, this only encourages further resistance, but for a variety of reasons, they keep you know, perpetuating these actions. And through, you know, these new laws and attempts at administration, they confiscate the best land. They, you know, emplace people who are friendly to their rule, you know, using divide and rule type of tactics. And so, to your point exactly, they, you know, they're creating all of these grievances amongst the population, and so the over time, members of the population are asking and demanding, you know, hey, we want a part of this, you know, political representation. We need reforms. We need services, things like that, and you know, those are not given. So there's incremental reforms, but then a lot of the times the colonists end up, you know, pursuing their interests over the interests of the wider population, who are very understandably resentful.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of parallels to be made with the current situation. Well, not just current, but the longer history of Israel-Palestine, because as you note, the French sort of look at the Algerian resistors and say, oh, they're terrorists, or they'll say, oh, this revolt is part of the larger march of communism, and they're really ignoring the grievances. And I think you could make the argument very easily that Israel hasn't really listened to the grievances that not just Gazans, but Palestinians more generally have. And there is that. I think that's an important point to make, because if you don't understand why a population is resisting you, I mean, you know, there could be no like diplomatic solution. There could be no peace. Yeah. Do you want to comment on that? Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, seeing things as, you know, military problems. And so, you know, when there's really this broader context, I mean, that was sort of my, one of my main points that I wanted to get across in the article is, and the French, you know, some of the French observers who, the ones who ended up sort of not getting their say, like they were, like they saw through the bigger and saw the bigger picture. And they said, you know, as long as we pursue these brutal military solutions, like as long as we're here in Algeria pursuing these operations, like the, you know, the, like we will continue to encounter resistance, even if, and so there were observers in the 1900 or the 19th century who were saying this. They said, we'll keep fighting. Another group is going to come up, another group is going to come up until we actually address some of those grievances.
Where it becomes like an endless cycle in that way.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's, yeah, there's some fascinating, like, personal memoirs of the account, both by Algerians. Zohra Drif was a female member of the FLN. So she wrote about her time. And I think her account is really powerful because it talks, like, she talks about how, at the popular level, like, her mom passed down all these stories that she had learned from her mom about Algeria, and that that they passed down to their children and called it, regardless of what you're learning in school, when she was going to school in like the 1930s in French schools, and she had learned French, and it was this way to try and separate Algerians from their sort of from the past. So she would come home from school and talk about all these things that she had learned about the French, and her mom would then tell her, well, this is the story of our people. And it was oral histories of the Emir Abdel Kader, who had fought against the French in, the 1830s, and the stories of atrocities that had been carried out by the French against against Algerians. And so, there's this popular history of resistance, and that continued to grow and be passed down almost, in many ways as a product of more harsh repression that that the French were doing. And so I think there are, a lot of parallels in really in any independence movement or any nationalist struggle where these the harsh repressive tactics are just engendering even greater and solidifying this sense of community, sense of nationalist struggle, and people's participation in that. And so I talk about that in the article because I think there was this, I came across this really fascinating passage where the population in Algeria and a lot of the rural areas had been displaced. There are some parallels. There's some significant differences with some of the with the displacement going on in Gaza right now. But in Algeria, they were displaced and then forced into these resettlement camps, and that has a history to it as well. But these camps where people died of disease, malnutrition, exposure, and all of these things, that, like, the observers and the people who went and saw the camps and then saw the effects of it, in many ways that experience actually heightened or increased the sense of nationalist struggle for the people who were.
In other words, it would kind of convince, say, moderate Algerians to support, more hardline resistance.
Yeah. So, I mean, it made, people even more committed, and then it made people, gave people a sense that they had suffered for this. And then it also, like, it, it discredited many of the moderates who were saying, in Algeria, there had been these various efforts at, assimilation was actually one of the big, there's a very sort of Algerian specific context to that, but efforts for reform and staying within overall French control. And like one of the interesting components of that was that, like, Algeria was actually considered part by the French. It was considered part of France, and so an extension of French territory. And so there were some who saw, okay, we can work within that system, and we can make, Algeria, like, part of France, and, France is the land of, liberty, equality, fraternity. Like, we'll be equal citizens with the French, and that'll be great. But, in practice, those, like, the Algerians were not being treated with equal rights by any, stretch of the imagination. And so the people who were advocating for that and were saying, hey, we can achieve our means through, through petitions through slow reforms and through participation in assemblies and things like that. Like, they just didn't have anything to show for their efforts. And so it's like, look where this has gotten us. Like, nowhere.
Well, I was going to say, it brings to mind a point you bring up that, and I think this applies to the Gaza situation. You know, there's this idea that gets thrown around of collective responsibility and also, you know, collective punishment. So, you know, I think in the Gaza discourse we have now, I do know people that say, well, you know, there are people that don't differentiate between Hamas and just Palestinians in the same way that the French didn't necessarily differentiate between armed resistance groups in Algeria and just Algerians more generally. And that leads to like real problems, right?
Yeah. Well, and so this is like, there's interesting, you know, from like a security perspective or securitization sort of perspective, which we get a lot of that sort of security discourse now, and sort of the American perspective on a lot of foreign foreign crises, foreign different things around the world, like applying that and seeing, okay, well, you know, the population, seeing it only from a security perspective. So, okay, the population must be this insurgency is relying on the population for support, and so therefore, like, you know, we need to do whatever we can to separate the insurgents from the population. So if that means displacing the population, if it means detaining a ton of people, if it means cutting off, so going to collective punishment, you know, cutting off electricity, cutting off water, cutting off fuel, cutting off humanitarian assistance, things like that. You know, under the reasoning or the logic of military necessity, you know, that then creates conditions where the military, like the military imperative or, you know, the military goals really take center stage, and you lose that appreciation for that, the broader political sort of environment, or the broader political considerations, where, you know, if this only becomes a military problem, like one of the French officers said, like, it's using, you know, a sledgehammer to kill fleas. Like, you might be solving this military problem militarily, like in the Battle of Algiers. You use, like, it becomes this not just cycle, but there's an increasing sense of using whatever means is necessary in order to achieve that that military solution. And so you know, not respecting disproportion, or you know, the laws of proportionality, distinction, and other aspects of the laws of armed conflict and things like that. And so you know, so I think I'm getting into a bit of a, going on a bit of a rabbit trail here.
No. I get what you're saying. I think you're moving towards the idea that, you know, when you become narrowly focused only on having a military solution, you know, that military solution then becomes, well, the only way that we can deal with the problem is total victory. And the thing is, I mean, total victory is achieved through very brutal means. And oftentimes it's not actually, I think it's not achievable necessarily. I mean, I think there's a lot of consideration now being given to the idea that, you know, the aims that Netanyahu's regime in Israel has with regards to Gaza are not feasible. So I think you're getting at how this idea of, well, there has to be a military solution rather than any other solution, it becomes a foolhardy pursuit in a lot of ways.
Right. And what's, you know, one of the dangers of it is it gathers its own momentum. And so, like, you know, you get these sunken costs where, you know, we've invested so much into this in terms of lives, in terms of resources, all these other things, like, you know, we need to see this through because we've already sacrificed so much. Or, but that, like, that's a very different logic than, you know, why you start this campaign, or what you're seeking. If what you're actually seeking is long-term stability and preventing something like this from happening in the future, like, this is only creating more long-term problems, because for every child who has been, you know, blown up or killed or starved to death, or on, you know, or Israeli soldier who's died during these operations, like, for all of this death and destruction, like, they're creating more grievances and, you know, more victims. And, you know, as we have seen in previous conflicts and previous wars in relation to Israel-Palestine, like, you know, with Israel's invasion and occupation of southern Lebanon, like, it's in the aftermath of that that Hezbollah and Hamas emerge. And, you know, prior to that, and the emergence of Fatah in the, you know, 1950s. And so these, regardless of the military victory that is achieved, since those underlying political grievances and the political struggle were not addressed meaningfully, you know, you just get another round of this violence. And so,
well, you get new armed resistance groups that emerge, right, out of that. And it really is like an example of, you know, they say, what is that saying, that insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, even though it doesn't work. I mean, you know, the only real solution to a lot of problems with regards to, I mean, Israel and Palestine, but also other issues, seems to be that, you know, you have to address the core grievances. And I mean, the way a lot of experts have put it to me is that at the end of the day, the only solution to this problem is going to be a political one or a diplomatic one.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that the whole point of my, I mean, why I started thinking about this was, just looking at, well, I mean, thinking from my previous experience in the Army, and like, the United States, the U.S. Army has a, like, counterinsurgency doctrine that is, you know, available to the public and can be examined. And in that, they talk about how, you know, like, proper counterinsurgency strategies, which this was the stuff that I learned about when I was in the Army, you need to, like, those are only part of, or they support this larger political process. And if you don't, if there isn't a adequate political process, then you know, all of the counterinsurgency in the world isn't going to achieve its ends. And so I started thinking about that, and they talked about Algeria, the French in Algeria, actually, as a case study, and the lessons that can be learned from that. But there, I mean, there are a lot of other cases too that I know people have talked about. Ireland, Ireland's an interesting case study where, you know, there's a revolt in the 1920s, actually starting earlier than that, but during World War One, which is, you know, fascinating to think about the broader context there. But and so when people feel that they have met, or some of their underlying grievances have been addressed, like the Irish receiving, or, you know, achieving independence partially, it wasn't the full independence in terms of all of Ireland, because there's the separate treatment of Northern Ireland, but when people felt that their underlying political grievances had been addressed, and they had been involved in that process, like, that allowed for you know, gradual resolution of that conflict. And it didn't happen overnight, and I mean, there were there was violence again in the 1970s and 80s, but you know, those very difficult processes of resolving those larger problems are still, you know, like, I think we can look at those and see that those are still preferable to, you know, long-term occupation and this repetition of these various examples of continued conflict. And it's interesting because it, thinking back to your comment about doing the same thing over and over again, like it reminds me of the, you know, what some analysts had called the mowing the grass strategy that the Israeli military had basically adopted in attacking into Gaza after you know, every few years to degrade Hamas's and its allies' military capabilities. But again, it's like those are short, you know, military solutions that don't provide any sort of long-term stability or address those larger.
With regards to Gaza, is there anything else you want to say about Gaza in particular? Because we've talked about the French experience in Algeria. What can we say about Gaza? And maybe what's your take on how we think about Gaza, how we think about Hamas? I know you have a few comments about that in the article. Maybe what do you think we focus on too much, and what do you think we focus on too little when it comes to Western attention on Gaza?
Yeah, sure. So that's a thank you. That's a great question. I think this, you know, misunderstanding of the Palestinians in general and the you know, sort of political complexity of Palestinian politics, the myriad of political factions, Hamas in general. And, you know, when I say misunderstanding, I'm not saying like, you know, misunderstanding these are, you know, nice guys kind of thing. Like, my point is not understanding that, you know, there are a number of factions that have a variety of goals and they're all competing. And so there's this, there are these struggles within Hamas and the larger Palestinian political community. And
yeah, there's factions both within Hamas, and then there's also factions within, you know, the Palestinians in
yeah,
general.
So
you know, Hamas is just one faction. Yeah,
right. Yeah, and so all of these others. And so so, you know, brutal attacks against these groups is only emboldening the more hardline political leaders who say, and military leaders who say, you know, we need, you know, look where politics has gotten us. Nowhere. Like, there are, you know, settlements being constructed. There's 500,000 settlers in.
It feeds into maximalist positions on both
exactly.
sides. I didn't mean to interrupt you, but.
No, thanks. That's a nice, succinct way of getting to the point. And so the maximalists end up, you know, being the only ones who, you know, the ones who basically have taken control and who are seen with the most legitimacy. And so, you know, I think there are some lessons here where in Algeria with the FLN, yeah, the maximalists ended up winning out because they, you know, there had been all these efforts at addressing those causes by people who weren't the maximalists, but for, you know, the fact that they had been ignored, brushed aside, and marginalized for 100 and some years, like, they weren't left. And partly because of the FLN was brutal to the, you know, in its own consolidation of control. And so, you know, Hamas has its efforts to consolidate control and eliminate any sort of competition and other, you know, potential sources of authority. And so, I mean, there have been struggles within Hamas between like the political wings and military wings, elements that are outside of the country, elements that are in Gaza. And so you have, you know, I list a couple of episodes where in the like mid-2000s and then more recently, 5, 10 years ago, there were efforts by elements of the political wing of Hamas to where they were hinting at or directly saying that they were willing to work within the parameters of the two-state solution.
The 67 borders, accepting the 67 borders, yeah.
Within the Arab Peace Initiative from 2002 and some of those things. And so there were, you know, there's these gestures from one faction of accepting the solution. And then, you know, for every effort by one of these groups, you then have, you know, another faction who then is, you know, trying to assert its own authority and saying, you know, no, we need to continue this fight. And so, I mean, but then when, you know, and pushing for its own maximalist demands and things like that. So you have this competition between these various factions within Hamas, and to allow the efforts at ceasefire and peace to completely fail and not have any sort of to be seen as completely ineffective, like, that's just adding fuel to the maximalists who say, look, like, what they're proposing, nobody's going to support, and it isn't working, and it isn't getting us anywhere.
Right. And it even goes beyond Hamas, because, you know, I mean, Hamas doesn't always necessarily get along with other Palestinian groups. I mean, it's not, you know, sure, it's not like a fan of the PLO or anything, or Fatah, but the Palestinian Authority. And, you know, even people often forget, before October 7th, there were protests against Hamas in Gaza, and a lot of those were crushed. Now, that may be different now, because as Gaza is being bombed and civilians are dying as well as combatants, you know, that may actually create a rally around the Hamas effect for Gazans. Which brings me to another key point I wanted to get at. One thing I often hear when you bring up these issues is people will say, well, you know, this is just the nature of war. Civilians are going to die. Why can't Israel just, you know, fight the war it has to fight to protect its people from Hamas? And I'm like, well, it's not as simple as that, because, you know, if you don't take into consideration civilian life, that can lead to problems later on. Can you speak to that issue?
Yeah, sure. I mean, in a way, like, you know, why I wanted to, or one of the reasons I wrote this article too, is this, you know, this idea that, like, military necessity, you know, somehow, you know, validates ignoring all of these, you know, conventions and law, international law that we've come up with, like, you know, over the course of time, like those, you know, the Geneva Conventions, all of these things, like, these were put in place out of, you know, in the aftermath of horrible conflict. And the, you know, the Fourth Geneva Convention was created after World War II, when they saw that, oh, our earlier conventions only, you know, focused on combatants, and look at all this, the devastation of civilians, which, you know, took place. Yeah, the justification for military necessity, there are, I mean, within all of these, you know, laws, like, there are procedures for military necessity, and that's where you get things like proportionality and distinction and all these things. And there's, you know, other, but so to ignore those, you know, I mean, there's a lot of moral issues there. And then there's these legal issues. Like, you know, one thing I wanted to show with this article is, like, from the same military logic that gets you, hey, in the short term, this will lead to our victory. Like, yes, it can lead to short-term military victories, but on a just as pragmatic level, military logic, this is creating more enemies, like, more future potential enemies.
So even from, like, the strategic military perspective, you know, in the long run, you know, this can actually lead to self-defeating, you know?
Right. And so that's the point. And so, I mean, there are all these other, you know, important considerations, and, like, the horrific civilian suffering. Like, I don't mean to downplay that at all. My point is just, you know, when you're saying, hey, I see that, but we need to focus on the military objective. Like, no, by that, but that you're rationalizing is going to lead to future problems in the future, in addition to all the horrible things that are going on now. And so, you know, this entire generation that's completely traumatized, and people who are, you know, entire families destroyed, people who are going to, you know, in addition to the death and maiming and destruction, people who are going to grow up with this, you know, the trauma and destruction, like, even from the military perspective, though, like, this is going to militarily create future conflicts in the future. And frankly, like, the soldiers who are carrying out these operations themselves, they're going to be dealing with the consequences of the destruction that they have, done in the course of their operations. And so, you know, those, like, you know, the idea that people need to just support, you know, support the troops. I mean, like, you know, people did that with, talked about that in the U.S. Military interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan. And like, I can tell you, American soldiers are living with the consequences of, you know, the operations that they conducted, and, you know, the death and destruction that, you know, are a part of, those wars. And so, you know, from the military's perspective itself, like, in addition to everything else, like, there's a very real military reason why this should, you know, needs to change direction immediately.
Yeah, I was going to bring up, you know, I saw a video a while back. It was around the time the Gaza war, this round of it, started. And it was a video of a little girl in Gaza. And, you know, she was being asked if she was okay by her mom and all this stuff. And then, you know, the kid said something interesting, which was Israel is doing the bombing, you know, and I just want to go back to school. And what, you know, but she specifically was blaming Israel for what was happening. And I was thinking to myself, if that kid survives this, they're going to remember this. And, you know, whether you think Israel is justified or not, that's not the question. The thing is, she's going to remember that, you know, she could become, you know, an armed resistance fighter, you know, what, and I don't think people consider that I think there are some people that assume that just full brutal military force is enough to solve all these problems. And I think that A, that's wrong. And B, it actually plays into the hands of armed groups and whatnot. I mean, I've talked to terrorism experts about this, you know, like Robert Pape, who has said to me that there's sort of a bait and bleed strategy that terrorists have, where, you know, they sort of want their enemies to give the most brutal response because that creates more recruits for the terrorist group or the resistance group or the armed group. Yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, just from, you know, from like leaning back into some of my own experience, the, you know, which there are a lot of differences, obviously. But I mean, you know, in Afghanistan, you know, you don't have to, you know, when civilians were killed, like, regardless of the reason, regardless of, you know, what happened, like, it's pretty clear that, you know, like, when, you know, innocent people were killed, like, that was a recruitment for the Taliban. And so, you know, you can understand why people go and join a resistance group when, you know, when they've seen their family members, you know, killed, right, you know, in many cases right in front of their eyes. And so, you know, I don't want to focus just on, like, it's easy to, like, I don't want to focus too much on this, like, the security discourse part of this, where, you know, it's necessarily future, you know, members of armed resistance. But I mean, that is part of the argument here, where it's, you know, creating more problems in the future. And so, I mean, at the very least, it's, you know, somebody who is probably a lot less likely to, work with that, those, like we were talking, that sort of middle where there's or somebody who's more willing to support the hardline positions, at least.
Right. And I'm sorry if I'm focusing so much on like the pragmatic strategic military perspective and consequences of actions and whatnot, but I guess I focus in on that sometimes because I think there's pockets of the public that have this sort of Rambo-esque view of how war works, and it's not exactly been very beneficial to any of us for people to think that way about it, because it's just not how war works, or it's not how counterinsurgency works.
But I mean, you bring up a really important, and I'm glad you're actually talking about this, because I meant to mention this earlier, but got on sort of a different track. And so, I mean, I think like it's very important to note that, I mean, the historical interpretation of these, conclusions or these arguments that I'm making, are contested. And so, I mean, there are a lot of people who think, if the U.S. had only been more brutal in Afghanistan, like we would have won the war in Afghanistan, or if the U.S. had been more brutal, had taken the gloves off, is sort of the, one of the terms I've heard, in Iraq or in Vietnam, like, oh, if only, we'd bombed even more. That, and so the same thing existed in Algeria, where you have with the French. And so you have these contending interpretations by soldiers, and many of the soldiers saw, like, hey, what we're doing is very counterproductive. We need to take a much more a very different approach. But then you had aspects of the French public who, some of them had a different understanding because they weren't in Algeria seeing what was going on, but there were also elements within the French army who said, no, the problem is we haven't been hard enough. And so there's a struggle between, even more violence to, okay, let's identify some of these underlying causes here. And so, so I think to your point where you say, some people are the Rambo-esque approach, like, I think there's something to that. And I think, taking like my point about like the lessons of counterinsurgency or whatever, like, I mean, that's not like those points are not universally appreciated. And so, like, and a lot, I mean, a lot of the critiques, of them, are very powerful and unfortunately very politically powerful. And I think a lot of those, in some ways those become then a maximalist position for policymakers. And so,
right.
Even more and more and more force, which ultimately, I mean, my point in the article, which I've framed through this sort of security discourse, and so it's not just your the questions you're asking, but so the way I framed it, ultimately that is self-defeating. And so we can see, looking at these different historical episodes, that it is. And so in cases where militaries have suppressed various movements, like a lot of times then 10, 20 years later, another movement comes along that is addressing those same unresolved
blowback
independence efforts. And so, blowback is a fascinating sort of paradigm as well that, I've been thinking about. And
I know you say it's contested, but obviously you do come down on the side of, maybe the total force side of things does not work out very well. Is there anything you want to add to that? Like, what would you say to someone who thinks, just go in there and, bomb the hell out of them or whatever? I mean, I remember when we went into Afghanistan, I remember I knew people at my high school that would say, oh, we should just, like, we don't do enough. We should start bombing every mosque. And I'm like, to me, that was just insane. I'm like, that's just going to make the population there hate you. But How do you respond to people that have this, like, no, you got to be tougher than tough mentality?
I mean the power of that, and the seductive power of that is frustrating and is challenging. And it's often, I mean, it's what, in some ways it's what, we are surrounded by through various forms of media and, what we grew up learning and things like that. And so, I mean, really looking at the history and, looking at, who's in charge in Afghanistan right now and, what happened in Iraq a couple of years after the United States left, like ISIS took over, and then looking back throughout other episodes of history where like this, like Vietnam is a great, it's horrible, but it's a good example too, because after, before, one thing that a lot of Americans might not appreciate is before the US fought in Vietnam, the French had, fought in Vietnam as well for short of 10 years, ended up at Dien Bien Phu. And so, people tried, I mean, people, the US and the French dropped a lot of bombs on a lot of people. And, that really only increased the resolve of the people who survived and, and the legacies of those campaigns, are still with us, and the horrible devastation there. And so, looking beyond the very superficial sort of parallels, like history, like a deeper look into these historical episodes shows that that does not, total force does not achieve the ends that are desired. And so I think, people are, Americans often, they apply, we often apply historical lessons somewhat loosely, or in the, like, we make parallels that are not accurate. And so, somebody may look at this, what I've written about Algeria, and look at that. But I think, like, there are useful examinations of parallels, but then there are also ones that are very dangerous. And so a lot of Americans apply parallels from World War II. And I remember, like, in high school, the Bush administration talking about invading Iraq as, within the parallel of World War II and stopping Hitler and the Nazis. And so, I mean, that was a completely inaccurate historical parallel, but it was very emotionally powerful and, informed by Americans' understanding of their understanding of World War II. And so, so I think, the lessons that Americans choose to learn from World War II and, ideas of total destruction and total war, that's not accurate to apply. I mean, you have to be very careful in applying these
Yeah,
parallels.
I mean, there's lessons to be learned from that
Right.
World War II, analogy, right? Like, there are lessons there, but there's also
Right.
lessons to be learned from Iraq, from Vietnam, from Algeria, and I think sometimes people lose sight of that it's not, we're not just limited to looking at World War II, to understand, hey, what's the proper decision to make in this
Right.
scenario from a historical perspective if we look back at history?
Yeah. Or, are we, is this apples? And this, we're comparing apples and oranges. And so I got on a bit of a rabbit trail again. Apologies. But yeah, so I think that, in short, the idea of, scorched earth tactics, I mean, like, you can look at, I mean, historical archives of, where armies have practiced those tactics, and it ultimately is self-defeating, and in many cases, I mean, the civilians and the non-combatants end up, paying the biggest consequences for that. And that's awful. So if in order to achieve your goal, you have to, I'm using the air quotes. Yeah. You have to, destroy the entire population. Like, then maybe your goal is not the right, then maybe you need to reevaluate your goal. Like, because destroying an entire population is, and however that's done, if that's, by dispersing people into, other countries, and then, under the understanding that they would eventually be assimilated into other, other populations. And, if that is what is needed to accomplish a goal needed, like, then that goal is terrible. Like,
right. Right. So needed in quotes, as you point out. Yeah. No, I get what you mean. Like, is this really should this be our goal if this is what, it requires? Yeah.
And so the idea I heard, one of your previous discussions where the securitization and sort of the future of preventing something from ever happening, like, that begins a very slippery slope then of where, everybody is a potential, and the society itself becomes the enemy and the problem. And then you're talking about the destruction of a society. So.
What do you mean everyone becomes a potential?
Like
a potential threat, a potential next.
Potential future threat. And so this security discourse is very dangerous, and it, leads to, treating the population as the enemy. And, when that happens, you're going to get.
The last thing I wanted to touch upon was, you ended the article with this line, and I'll read it out loud. Americans must learn from these lessons by understanding the full context of the current war in Gaza and recognize the ultimately self-defeating impact of Israel's pursuit of an overwhelmingly brutal military, quote-unquote, total victory facilitated by unconditional U.S. support. Now, it's funny because I was reading a War on the Rocks piece earlier today that was saying, Israel's goals need to be reassessed. These goals are not achievable, and in fact, they're counterproductive, et cetera, et cetera. That article was saying that Israel needs to learn from the lessons of 9/11 and the war on terror and the mistakes the U.S. made. You're saying that Americans need to learn these lessons in relation to Gaza. So why do you say America? I mean, I'm assuming you would say this also applies to Israel, that Israel should learn these lessons as well. But why do you want to point that out to Americans when it comes to Gaza?
Well, because I think many Americans don't recognize the role that the United States plays in the support for Israeli military operations. And, that takes a variety of forms, diplomatic support at the United Nations, and simple, military support in terms of whether that's munitions, intelligence sharing, all sorts of other things. So there's. And then I would argue then that in addition to that, and the diplomatic support, it's not just the UN, it's the way the US has shaped discussion of political solutions, or, has used its energy, the US government has used its energy to, like support Mahmoud Abbas and things like that, which, like, the vast majority of Palestinians do not support Mahmoud Abbas. And so the diplomatic solutions that the United States plays a very powerful role in sort of, what is possible. Like, the U.S. government predetermines that to a large extent and amplifies and chooses which elements of Palestinian political scene get a voice at the table, or even, whether they even get to sit at the table, or whether the table is, U.S. representatives, Israeli representatives, and Arab states with no Palestinian representation. So that has been while still pushing a narrative of being this impartial moderator or not.
It's really not necessarily giving Palestinians a choice in determining their future. It's kind of us saying, well, this is who we want to put in place, you know.
Right. Yeah. And so, So, I mean, my point is just the United States government plays like a very powerful role in both the enabling continued military operations, and then and so you look at the like UN votes for ceasefire going back several months. You know, the US vetoing them as they consistently came up. So, you know, that and then providing ammunition, weapons, things like that has also enabled the conflict to continue. And, you know, whether or not to apply any pressure in terms of allowing humanitarian assistance, you know, beyond just sort of a, you know, the smallest of efforts that are not, you know, really large enough to be to make a meaningful difference. So the U.S. plays a major role in this, and I think that you know that enables what's going on, and so like I think Americans need to be aware of that and aware that, you know, like our perspectives on this is vastly different than how people in the region see U.S. foreign policy. And
well,
so,
not to interrupt you, but I don't think it's just limited to the region. So I wanted to mention this like before we close out. I mean, one thing that concerns me, and it actually came up in an interview that, of all people, Donald Trump did with an Israeli publication the other day, where he said, you know, you have to be very careful. You're going to be losing support from a lot of the world. You're starting to, you know, maybe go too far, is what he said in this interview. And I'm not like a big Trump fan, but I think that's a point worthy of consideration, because a lot of the rest of the world, which I think had a lot of goodwill towards Israel immediately after October 7th, is looking at what's happening in Gaza and saying, okay, this is going too far now. Look at all these deaths that are happening, especially of these civilians. And I think that affects not only Israel, but also the U.S. Because, you know, the global South looks at this and is like, you know, why should we trust the U.S.? Why should we better relations? Because I do think a lot of the global South is very, very sympathetic to Palestinians.
Sure.
So, I mean, this affects our relations with a lot of different countries.
Right. And so on, like something I've written about a little bit, I'm pushing anything on, but like public opinion in a lot of, I'm going to sort of narrow it back again just to countries in the Middle East and North Africa, but a lot of the public opinion there is furious at the governments of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, a lot of other places. Like, you know, they're furious at their governments for not doing more. And so then it puts governments in Middle East and North Africa in a place where, you know, the U.S. government is pressuring them to do one thing. Their people are pressuring them to actually reflect the concerns of the people, which, you know, obviously. But so as those governments then repress the dissent of, you know, their population, who are resentful of what's going on, and who often, you know, have family in Gaza or the West Bank, who they're losing family, they're losing friends, and they're mad that, you know, their government isn't doing more to try and stop this. Like, that's creating problems in those countries. And so the, you know, the governments in those countries then many times decide to become more repressive and repress that dissent. So that's creating, you know, future blowback in those countries as well. You know, because the U.S. government is then pressuring those governments to keep, you know, to keep this popular, you know, mobilization, agitation under control, so that they continue to support U.S. policies. And so, you know, sometimes that means, you know, hey, here's, you know, a bunch of F-35s. So, you know, to buy your support, like, so that you now support US policies. But the population then is outraged. And so, I mean, it's increasing support all over, or it's increasing resentment against governments all over the region. And so, I mean, we saw popular
right. It's the whole issue of the Arab street versus the leadership. Yeah.
For sure. And so, you know, you have the Arab Spring uprisings from, 13 years ago. And so, like, this is creating, you're absolutely right. It, you know, the consequences of this are not going to be felt just in Gaza and Israel and West Bank. And they're going to be felt across the region. And then to your point as well, they're going to be felt around the world.
Well, hey, Sean, I want to thank you for coming on Parallax. Is there anything else you want to say in closing that I didn't get to? Or what do you hope my listeners get out of this conversation?
Well, first, thanks for having me on. I appreciate this opportunity to talk about this. Yeah, the main thing I want people to get from this is, you know, that studying military history shows us that brutal forms of counterinsurgency and the pursuit of military solutions ultimately is self-defeating, and that, you know, in any of these conflicts, where there are major political grievances, Palestinian, so in the case of the current Gaza war, Palestinian struggle for self-determination, for, you know, whether that's a two-state solution, one-state solution, there's been a number of different, you know, options discussed by people. But so the ultimate, you know, struggle for Palestinian statehood, Palestinian sovereignty, respect for human rights, those struggles that are, you know, decades long, century long, you know, the current war is just a small, I mean, it's awful and it's, you know, a major event, but that's one chapter in it. And so until the broader political grievances are addressed, previous iterations of conflict show that this will just this will continue in the future. And so there is no military solution. If Hamas is militarily defeated, another group will emerge eventually to challenge the status quo and the occupation in the future, and whatever comes out of the current conflict. So unless the political goals, the political grievances are addressed.
Thank you again, Sean, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed the conversation and that you'll consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. One more time, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. It is you, the listener, who makes this show possible. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say, don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxieties, problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.